So we will begin our study today with prayer, and then we'll turn our attention to our notes. Thank you, Lord. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has brought us to this Sabbath day, a day of rest, a day that you have apportioned to us to stand down, as it were, from our creative work, creative process, and to take all that we have labored for this week and to lay it at your feet, and to rest in how you will make it complete and bring us your favor. So, Lord, this is not just a day for us to back away and to stop working, but it's a day for us to behold your beauty and your goodness and the awesomeness of your hand at work. And we just thank you for this opportunity for us to gather like this and to have a Torah study. We ask, Lord, that you would help us in what we do, that you would anoint us, that we would have ears to hear what your Spirit has to say to us. And I pray that today, Lord, our hearts would be inclined towards you, and that you would inscribe your Torah upon our hearts as we learn to walk in your ways. And as we look at today's parsha of Go, that you would help us, and that we would gain not only intellectual insights, but Lord, that we would experience even a transformation in our lives, again, as we learn to walk in your ways. On behalf of these, I ask, Lord, that you would bless them, that you would help them, and you would touch their lives, and the people that they care for, that you would bless them and touch them, and that you would help us today. We pray for Bob Gorlick, as he is visiting his family in Minnesota, that you would bless their time, that it would be enriched for all of them. We pray these things in the name of Yeshua. Amen. So our study today is the Parsha Bo, and just sort of happens to be that it rhymes in English with its translation of go. Bo is go. And the Torah portion covers the section of Exodus 10 through chapter 13, verse 16. And we're going to begin with our looking at our notes we're going to look at an overview provided for us from Rabbi Sachs's Covenant and Conversation book on Exodus. And this overview will give us a thumbnail sketch, as it were, of the entire Parsha. But then we're going to look at a specific article from Jonathan Sachs and some observations from an article entitled Heart of Darkness. So as an overview, the Parsha of Bo details the last three of the plagues and the institution of Passover, both at the time of the Exodus itself and as it was subsequently to be celebrated. The long exile was at an end. It's coming to a close after more than 400 years. The Israelites are now beginning their journey to freedom. The first of the following essays focuses on the ninth plague, darkness, what was its significance and symbolism. And if you do have the copy of the book of Sachs's compilation, as it were, of his Covenant and Conversation articles, then for this section of Bo, he has several articles. We're going to be looking at the first one, Heart of Darkness, but he comments about the other articles. And if you don't have a copy of this, I would encourage you to acquire one. There's some very insightful articles from Jonathan Sachs. He says, though, the second article explores Moses' concern that the story of redemption be taught to future generations. What is the connection between education and freedom? The third article looks at the wicked child of the Haggadah and what this passage teaches about the collective nature of Jewish identity. And then the fourth article analyzes the extraordinary detail of God's insistence that the Israelites, before they leave, take vessels of silver and gold from the Egyptians as part payment for their work as slaves. Why was this so important as a preparation for freedom? So again, we're looking at the first of these articles today, entitled Heart of Darkness, and what is the significance and the symbolism of darkness. So Jonathan begins his article, Heart of Darkness. The ninth plague, darkness, comes shrouded in a darkness of its own, sort of like the darkness is encapsulated in a darkness. What is this plague doing here? Jonathan Sacks asks. It seems out of sequence. Thus far, there have been eight plagues, and they have become steadily, inexorably more serious. The first two, the Nile turning blood red and the infestation of frogs, seemed more like omens than anything else. The third and fourth, gnats and wild beasts, caused worry, not crisis. The fifth, the plague that killed livestock, affected animals, not human beings. The sixth, boils, was again a discomfort, but a serious one. No longer an external issue, but a bodily affliction. And he draws our attention to remember that it was something like this, that when Job lost everything that he had, that he did not start cursing his fate until his body was covered with sores, referencing Job chapter 2. And that's an interesting point, that oftentimes we can become sensitized to adversity in our world. In other words, the adversity that we are exposed to, our bodies and our brains become sensitized because of the level of exposure or the intensity of that exposure. And what's interesting, because of how the brain works, is the exposure to adversities or difficulties around us does not have to be actual experiences. There's a portion of our brain in the front part of our brain that records cognitive information, and it's from here we have the capacity to make distinctions between what is real, what is not real, what is fantasy, and what is reality. But there's another part of our brain at the back of our brain, just below our scalp, that has a recording device that records our sensory experiences, and it does not have the capacity to make distinctions between fantasy and reality. And so what is helpful is when these different parts of our brain are working together in an integrated way. But when we are living reactively, when our lives are based on fear, to just kind of give it a general description, when a person is living their life on a basis of fear, and they're in survival mode, or they're often reactive, then the brain is not working in an integrated way. And this sensory recording device of our brain tends to act on its own. And in that, it's most difficult for an individual to make a distinction between what's real and what's fantasy. And how this connects here is that when we begin to experience the affliction in our body, oftentimes that's a trigger that brings us to the awareness of what is real and what is not. And until something personally affects us, until it hits home, oftentimes we'll phrase it that way, when it hits home, when we really have had a wake up call, then we become much more aware of the reality. But short of that, oftentimes we become sensitized because of our exposure to things like television programming and movies and news reports. And whether we're watching a report of what happened or an adversity that happened to someone else, or an adversity that's portrayed in a dramatic way in a film, a movie, a television show. Again, we become so overly exposed to things like violence, death, mayhem, adversities of all kinds, that our body and brain can become sensitized to it. In other words, because of the level of exposure, even to what is not real, but is portrayed as if it's real, has a tendency to sensitize us. And until it comes home, until it becomes personal, we often seem unaffected or untouched or unmoved by what happens to others. And so that's an interesting and an important aspect to appreciate about how the human body works, because as we see in the sixth plague, the boils, it's a discomfort, but it becomes a serious one because it's no longer an external issue. It's no longer about what is happening to other people or what is happening to the animals or what is happening to the water or what is happening to the ground, but what is now happening to me. It's becoming personal to the Egyptians. So continuing with the article, Sachs says, the seventh and eighth plagues, hail and locusts, destroyed the Egyptian grain. Now it's becoming even much more close and personal. Now with the loss of grain added to the loss of the livestock and the fifth plague, there's no food. Still to come was the tenth plague, the death of the firstborn in retribution for Pharaoh's murder of Israelite children. It would be this that eventually broke Pharaoh's resolve. So we would expect the ninth plague, this one between where now, you know, in the seventh and eighth plague, it's coming home, it's a loss of food, it's impacting people's lives personally. There's a reality that has set in here. And between that seventh and eighth plague and the tenth, we would expect, he says, this ninth plague to be a very serious one indeed, something that threatened even if it did not immediately take human life. Instead, we read what seems like an anticlimax. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky so that the darkness will spread over Egypt. Darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or leave his place for 3 days. Yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Darkness, he writes, is a nuisance, but no more. The phrase darkness that can be felt suggests what happened. A khamsin, a sandstorm of a kind not unfamiliar in Egypt, which can last for several days, producing sand and dust-filled air that obliterates the sun, or obliterates the light of the sun. A khamsin is usually produced by a southern wind that blows into Egypt from the Sahara Desert. The worst sandstorm is usually the first of the season in March. This fits the dating of the plague, which happened shortly before the death of the firstborn on Pesach. So for anyone who has visited Arizona during its monsoon season, which would be the months, the end of May, beginning of June, all the way through mid-September, sometimes into early October. if you've ever visited here in Phoenix area or in Arizona, it is likely that you might have experienced what we would call locally a sandstorm, or there's a borrowed Arabic term that's caught on here in this area called a haboob. And this is what we're talking about here, a Khamsin, a Sirocco would be a North African term, or a haboob, or a sandstorm. Now, the sandstorms that we experience here in Arizona can be pretty significant. We've had the experience in the middle of the day, even around the noon hour when the sun is at the highest peak in the sky, that the sandstorm would be so intense, the kicking up of dust so intense, that it would be as night. Worse than even a fog where you could not see the white lines on the road. And when these things happen and you're out in your car, everyone is instructed or advised to pull over and stop your vehicle. And so for those of us here in the Southwest, this is something we're familiar with. And it happens when things are dry and monsoon season is simply means a changing of the wind's direction. Instead of blowing from the typical west, it's now blowing up from the south. And so it's this southern wind that we're looking at here coming up out of the Sahara Desert. And it's, again, during a time when it's generally hot and it's dry and the wind is strongly blowing. Now, what's interesting is that we read a portion in Genesis 41:6, and it says, "And behold, after them sprouted seven ears, thin and blighted by the east wind." So this is the context in Genesis 41 when Pharaoh, not the Pharaoh of the time that we're looking at in today's portion, but the Pharaoh who was the reigning king of Egypt at the time Joseph was still in prison. So we're going back in time here just a little bit. And you might remember that Pharaoh had a dream that disturbed him, and his servants and those around him and his counselors could not successfully interpret the dream or help him make sense out of it. And he was reminded by one of his servants who had previously been imprisoned that there was a Hebrew there, Joseph, who had a skill, a talent for interpreting dreams. And so this is a reference to one of the drama lines or storylines, the narrative of what Pharaoh then was experiencing in his dream, that this east wind came up out of the south and it blistered these ears of corn and caused them to be thin and blighted. And so we'll see several times throughout the Tanakh a reference to an east wind. And this is a kadim, and it's often used in the Bible as an instrument of God with really not any significance in direction. In other words, the idea of an east wind is not necessarily because of a wind that's blowing from the east. Rather, the idea or the phrase that gets translated east wind is more of an idiom or a Hebraism referring to an instrument that God is using. We see this in Exodus 10:13. Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind upon the land all that day and that night. And when it was morning, the east wind had brought the locusts. So one of the previous plagues to this portion this week, the plague of the locusts, they come upon the land because of an east wind. And that's not because the wind was blowing from the east, but the idea that an east wind is a Hebraism of an instrument that God is using for confrontation. in Exodus 14:21, what we will see in a portion that's coming later after this week's portion, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. Again, this is not because there was a wind per se coming out of the east, but rather the idea of an east wind being an instrument. It's a Hebraism. And what we see here is that this idea of kedim or east wind is, it incorporates two basic concepts. Most often, the first of the two is this is an instrument used for confrontation, to confront or to meet someone with either good or a bad intent, a positive or a negative intention. Either way, this east wind is an instrument that God uses to confront or to meet people. Secondly, it can be the idea of preceding someone or something either temporarily or geographically. In other words, the idea of an east wind is what is preceding. So if we think about this darkness as a kedim, and Sachs is connecting it to the idea of a kedim or an east wind, that this darkness, something, because we're studying today to understand what is this darkness. As Sachs puts it, it's a darkness shrouded by darkness. It's a deep darkness. It's so dark that it blinds the light of the sun, and nighttime becomes as if it's day. But it's a thick, thick darkness that can be felt. So it's not only has a physical property, there's a psychological, there's a sensory property to it, because you not only are seeing it, but in experiencing it, there is a sensory, it to the level you can feel it. And so when we see this, we want to understand, what is this darkness? So it's an instrument. In just simple terms, it is an instrument that the Lord is using. And he's using this to confront Pharaoh and to confront the Egyptian people. But it's also being used as an instrument to precede. So it's the ninth plague. So what is the ninth plague preceding? It would be the tenth plague. And we know in the tenth plague is the death of the firstborn. And this is the Lord's retribution to Pharaoh and to Egypt, who has tolerated the destruction of children. And this is the measure for measure, or the retribution. So this darkness, in simple terms, is an instrument. It's an east wind, an instrument in the hands of the Lord to both confront Pharaoh and the Egyptians, but it's also a preceding of the 10th plague. It is a forerunner, if you will, of the 10th plague. Another comment by H.W. Wolfe, who likens this idea of kedim or east wind to the conception of time. And he describes it as a man in a rowboat rowing backwards into the future. So if you can picture yourself sitting in a rowboat and you're rowing forward, but your back is to the direction you're going. In other words, you're facing where you have been and your back is towards the direction where you're going, which is often the position that a person is in when they're in a rowboat rowing. Most often, rowers row backwards in the direction they're going. And with that image, what is in front of the person, the past that is in front of him or her, is the kedim, and the future is what's behind them. So with this, let's return to Sachs's article. The ninth plague was doubtless unusual in its intensity, but it was not an event of a kind wholly unknown to the Egyptians, then or now. Why then does it figure into the plague narrative? In other words, this haboob, this windstorm, this kadim, this east wind that's come up out of the south is not an unusual occurrence. So why is it considered a plague? Why is it part of this plague narrative? Immediately prior to the climax, the 10th plague that's coming, why did it not happen nearer the beginning as one of the less severe plagues? The answer, Jonathan Sacks suggests, lies in the line from Dayanu. Dayanu is the song we sing as part of the Haggadah. If God had executed judgment against them, the Egyptians, but had not done so against their gods, it would have been sufficient. Twice, the Torah itself refers to this dimension of the plagues. I will pass through Egypt on that night, and I will kill every firstborn in Egypt, man and animal. I will perform acts of judgment against all the gods of Egypt. I alone am God. Exodus 12:2. And then in Numbers 33:4, the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, struck down by the Lord, and against their gods, the Lord had executed judgment. Not all the plagues were directed in the first instance against the Egyptians. Some were directed against the things they worshiped as gods. The things they worshiped as gods. Things that had been deified in their view. That is the case in the first two plagues. The Nile was personified in Egypt, in ancient Egypt, as the god Hapi, and was worshipped as the source of fertility in an otherwise desert region. Offerings were made to it at the time of inundation, time of great crowds. The inundations themselves were attributed to one of the major Egyptian deities, Osiris. The plague of frogs would have been associated by the Egyptians with Heket, the goddess who was believed to attend births as a midwife, and who was depicted as a woman with the head of a frog. The plagues were not only intended to punish Pharaoh and his people for their mistreatment of the Israelites, and that's an important point. That is a part of what is happening with the plagues and part of the Lord's intention, but it's not relegated to just that. Also, the plagues are there to show them the powerlessness of the gods in which they believed. And if you think about it for a moment, this is one of the most difficult things for men and women, for human beings, to come to grips with. When something that they have believed in for so long is proven to be a myth or false, not only not true, but perhaps has never been true. You might reflect for a moment. Perhaps someone has come to you, or you've had an experience, a conversation, and it was difficult to hear the message of the other person because their message is leading you to discover that something you held to, something you believed in, was not true, was not accurate. And part of having a growth mindset as a person who's committed to personal growth and development, part of that growth mindset is having a sense of openness to learn and not be afraid of information, to not be afraid of education. But what we find in many situations and in some people's lives, there is a resistance to knowledge, a resistance to education. I grew up myself in a culture and that was adverse to education. The culture that I grew up in often lampooned and criticized, maligned people who were educated and who sought to be educated. In the home that I grew up in, my mother and father were lovers of education, and they encouraged me to pursue education. My father, who is still alive and with me, continues to applaud my efforts to grow educationally and intellectually. But the culture that my father grew up in and the culture that I lived in, the culture itself, particularly the religious culture that I'm referring to, was disfavorable to education because they were afraid that the educated would rationalize faith and we would no longer trust in God. And it was that kind of environment that encouraged blind faith. And what we see here is these plagues of the Lord are not just punishing Pharaoh and the Egyptians for their mistreatment of the Israelites, but in fact is working to show them to pull back the veil of their own blindness, to see the powerlessness of all the deities, the gods, the things that they look to be gods, to be the controllers of their destiny, of their environment, those that would have the power to help them to be fertile and to be blessed and to be fruitful and productive and for economic growth, how all of that faith and trust was senseless because their gods, little g, is powerless to do anything about it. And that is a very difficult message to deliver. And oftentimes, because of the difficulty in delivering message, and essentially the difficulty is not so much in the delivery of the message. The difficulty is the openness of others to hear the message. You've heard this from Bob Gorlick before. In fact, I think he referenced this in last week's partial lesson, or maybe it was a couple weeks ago, that the most difficult barrier that you and I have, that any individual has to grow, develop, and move forward in our life is what we already know and what we already believe. The firmer my grip on what I know, the tighter my grip on what I believe, the less likely I am to learn and to be open to what I don't know and what I have not learned. And it brings to mind a quote that I like to share from Corrie Ten Boom. Many of you, if not all of you, probably remember who Corrie Ten Boom was, a woman who lived through the Holocaust, although her family, her sister, did not. And Corrie Ten Boom was noted for this statement. And she said, "Hold loosely to everything you know and to everything you have. Otherwise," she says, "it hurts when God pries your fingers open." And I've always thought that was so, it was a bit humorous, but it was also so right, so accurate. And that's what I found in my own life, that the times of my life where I was the most resistant, I had a grip so hard on what I already know, was the most difficult times of my life, and I was the least likely to grow and develop. Yet, oftentimes, because of the Spirit of God prying my fingers open in order that my heart would be open, I prayed a moment ago in our opening prayer that the Lord would help our hearts to be inclined towards Him. A heart that is inclined towards the Lord has relaxed its grip. A heart that is not inclined towards the Lord has already made up its mind how right it is. And so as we look at these plagues and as we look at this darkness, this is a demonstration to pull back the veil and to help Pharaoh and the Egyptians to not just help them, but to lead them to be confronted. This east wind, this darkness is confronting the people with the powerlessness and the absurdity of the gods that they worshiped. He continues in his article, what is at stake in this confrontation is the difference between myth, in which the gods are mere powers to be tamed, propitiated, and manipulated. The difference between the myth and biblical monotheism. What is biblical monotheism? Sachs explains here, ethics of justice, compassion, human dignity constitute the meeting point of God and mankind. The point of the meeting with the mythical gods, the meeting between the mythical gods and people, was always around the idea of taming the people or taming the anger of the gods. And who could outmanipulate the other? But in biblical monotheism, the connecting point between God and man, between God and human beings, is justice, compassion, human dignity. Recall, if you will, Micah 6:8. He has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. On one hand, Micah is summarizing all of Torah. The 610 commandments, if you will, are summarized in these three: to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly before God. And this is what's reflected in what Sachs is making comment here, that this is the whole of biblical monotheism. This is what stands in contrast to all that Egypt and Pharaoh represented and all that they did. This is the exact opposite of the experience of bondage in Egypt. Do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly before God. Again, Sachs continues in his article, the symbolism of these plagues, often lost on us, would have been immediately apparent to the Egyptians. Two things now become clear. The first is why the Egyptian magicians declared, this is the finger of God, only after the third plague, lice. The first two plagues would not have surprised them at all. That is, the Nile turning to blood and the frogs. They would have understood them as the work of Egyptian deities who, they believed, were sometimes just simply angry with the people and took their revenge. So the god of the Nile was angry and turned itself to blood. The god of Heket, a woman's body with the head of a frog, is angry, so sends frogs everywhere. But it's the third one, the lice, that where things start shifting and changing. The second is the quite different symbolism. The first two plagues were meant to have on the Israelites and for us. As with the 10th plague, these were no mere miracles intended to demonstrate the power of God of Israel, as if religion was a gladiatorial arena in which the strongest God wins. In other words, the plagues are not mere demonstrations of God's power, as if God was showing that he was the tougher bully on the block. This is not about matching wits with other powers. This is not a battle between the titans to see who wins and prevails. But instead, their meaning was moral. They represented, these plagues represented the most fundamental of all ethical principles stated in the Noahide covenant. In the words, he who sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. This is the rule of retributive justice, measure for measure. As you do, so shall you be done too. By first ordering the midwives to kill all male Israelite babies, and then, when that failed, by commanding every boy who is born must be cast into the Nile. Pharaoh had turned what should have been symbols of life, the Nile for its water, which fed Egyptian agriculture, and midwives, who were supposed to help bring life into the world. It turned what should have been symbols of life into agents of death. The river that turned to blood and the Heket-like frogs that infested the land were not afflictions as such, but rather coded communications, as if to say to the Egyptians, reality has an ethical structure. Reality has an ethical structure. See what it feels like when the gods you turned against the Israelites turn on you. If used for evil ends, the power of nature will turn against man, so that what he does will be done to him in retribution. There is justice in history. I don't know how much exposure you've had to the elements outside in the world, how much hiking or camping you might do or have done. Again, my reference point here being in the desert. And in Arizona, we have multiple climates. We have a desert climate. We have a Sonoran climate. We have up in the mountains, higher in the north part of Arizona, we have pine country, 7,000, 8,000 feet elevation. If you go up our mountains, can get up to 18,000 feet elevation. We have different kinds of climate. And if you don't understand the climate, if you don't understand the time of the year, that as beautiful as the terrain and the landscape is, it can be extremely terrifying and dangerous. And people who respect the climate and the territory and the landscape, and they go prepared and they respect the heat of the sun and the dryness of the climate, and they respect the creatures and how they maneuver and navigate, then you can optimize the joy of being in the midst of all of this creation. And it's not just true here in Arizona. This is a true statement for any place where you might live, where you might be and are enjoying the outdoors. But when we disregard the nature, when we disrespect it, when we use it for means other than what it was designed for, then we're on a trajectory to experience a retribution. And what we find is, again, what we've heard before, if we don't learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it. And this, again, is a part of the idea of the man or the woman in the rowboat rowing backwards into the future, because their view, the 2020 vision point of view, is to the past. And if you think about it, you and I do not have 2020 vision of tomorrow, but we are come closer to having 2020 vision of yesterday. And it's not that we're going back to yesterday or we're reliving yesterday. But yesterday used to be a tomorrow. But it came by so fast. We were so preoccupied and dissociated from our world. Tomorrow became yesterday before we even recognized what was happening. And so by being in the boat rowing backwards into the future, as it were, gives us an opportunity to learn and to review the history, to actually learn from it. And it's the lessons we learn from the past that equip us for navigating into the future. Again, Sachs continues in his article, hence the 10th plague, to which all the others were a mere prelude. Not just the 9th plague of the darkness, but all the 9 leading up to the 10th is a prelude to the 10th. Unlike all the other plagues, its significance was disclosed to Moses even before he set out on his mission, while he was still living with Jethro in Midian. From Exodus 4:22, you shall say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my son, my firstborn. I have told you to let my son go, that he may worship me. If you refuse to let him go, I will kill your firstborn son. Whereas the first two plagues were symbolic representations of the Egyptian murder of Israelite children, the tenth plague was the enactment of retributive justice, as if heaven was saying to the Egyptians, you committed or supported or passively accepted the murder of innocent children. There is only one way you will ever realize the wrong you did, namely, if you yourself suffer what you did to others. Now, that is a strong statement, isn't it? I mean, let's just measure it for a moment based upon its own merits. That is a strong statement. If we look at it only in the context of this context of Egypt, then it's, we might be too quick to say, yes, that's what they deserved. And that's not a point that I would argue. But this is an important statement for us to appreciate of what Sachs is representing here, that this is a coded message that the Lord is sending, that it's not just representing a murders that were done, but this is retributive justice now in the 10th plague. And it's a strong statement to consider that there is only one way that a person is going to realize that they did wrong, and that's when they suffer the way they've caused others to suffer. And again, it might be really easy for you and I to say, yes, let's let that happen. Yes, that's what should be, because we see ourselves apart. And so we are like pointing a finger at the Egyptians and saying, yes, they deserve that. Or yes, my enemy deserves that. But imagine that you or I are the ones who are standing before the judge of the earth, the judge of the universe. Is this the kind of judgment we want to experience? And maybe not so. And what we want to appreciate is that even though this is representative of what God did in Egypt, and perhaps has done in other contexts as well, that this extreme measure, if we might for a moment kind of label this as an extreme measure, takes place when all other measures have been exhausted. It's sort of like the flood in the time of Noah, where the entire earth is destroyed except for Noah, his wife, his sons, and his sons' wives. Why such an extreme measure? And if that's all we see is the story of the flood and the destruction of all who lived, then we miss the point until we back up and we see a larger picture of what led up to the prelude that led up to the flood. And the prelude that led up to the flood was God's mercy and God's slowness to anger, his long suffering. And the flood and the timing of the flood is a commentary on God's mercy. Because God withheld his wrath, he withheld retributive justice until there was only one family left, one righteous family left, and in a sense, one righteous man, Noah. God waited until he could wait no more. And so while there is the 10th plague, what we see in the 9th plague in darkness is the culmination of the prelude. And in the prelude is the mercy of God. It's in the prelude is the long suffering of God. It's in the prelude that we see God intentionally holding back. God is intentionally restraining himself in order others could repent, to give you and I and others that opportunity. And it's only when God can wait no more that we see the extreme action. Sachs writes, this too helps explains the difference between the two words the Torah regularly uses to describe what God did in Egypt. Otot u'moftim, signs and wonders. These two words are not two ways of describing the same thing, miracles. They describe quite different things. A mofet, a wonder, is indeed a miracle. An ot, a sign, is something else. It's a symbol, like tefillin or circumcision, both of which are called ot. That is to say, a coded message, a coded communication. The significance of the ninth plague is now obvious. The greatest god in the Egyptian pantheon was Ra, or Re, the sun god. The name of Pharaoh, often associated with the Exodus, Ramses II, means Mases, son of, as in Moses, Moshe, Mases, son of Ra, son of the god of sun. Egypt, so its people believed, was ruled by the sun. Its human ruler, or Pharaoh, was a semi-divine, the child of the sun god. In the beginning of time, according to the Egyptian myth, the sun god ruled together with Nun, the primeval waters. Eventually, there were many deities. Ra then created human beings from his tears. Seeing, however, they were deceitful, he sent the goddess Hathor to destroy them, and only a few survived. The plague of darkness was not a mofet, a wonder, but an ot. It's a sign. The obliteration of the sun signaled that there is a power greater than Ra. Yet what the plague represented was less the power of God over the so-called God of the sun, but rather it was the rejection by God of a civilization that turned one man, Pharaoh, into an absolute ruler, son of the sun god, with the ability to enslave other human beings. It's a rejection by God of a culture that could tolerate the murder of children, because that is what Ra himself did. When God told Moses to say to Pharaoh, "My son, my firstborn, Israel," he was saying, "I am the God who cares for his children, not one who kills his children." The ninth plague was a divine act of communication that said, there is not only physical darkness, but also a moral darkness. The best test of a civilization is to see how it treats children, its own and others. In an age of broken families, neglected and impoverished children, and worse, the use of children as instruments of war, that is a lesson we still need to learn. And so I want to share with you some observations in the time that we have remaining, and then we'll open it up and we'll talk about this. First, some observations I would share about the idea of darkness. And the word here for darkness is shared in other portions of the Tanakh and the scriptures. And it kind of gives us a further commentary on appreciating what this darkness is and what happens around it. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, we come to understand and appreciate that no matter what the darkness is and how deep it is, God is present in the midst of the darkness. In Genesis 1:4, we see in the creative act of Hashem, light and darkness are kept in order. In other words, there is a boundary. The light and the darkness are separated. Each is bound by a territory, by a boundary, And that is the order, that there is a defined order for light and there is a defined order for darkness. And in that order, the purpose of good is served. As long as light and darkness remain within their borders. And when the borders are compromised or not respected, then we have disorder or chaos, and the purpose of good is no longer served. In Genesis 1:18, we see that even though there is a separation of light and darkness, light is designated as the ruler over both the day and the night. There is a greater light and a lesser light, but light is designated as the manager, the regulator, the one who provides oversight to the day and the night. Again, when that is not respected, we no longer have order, we have chaos. There is a warning in Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who confuse darkness with light and light with darkness. In other words, there are components, there are properties, there are factors that define what light is and what darkness is. But there are those who would confuse those issues, and they would represent that light is darkness and that darkness is light. And that comes with a strong warning from God himself. In Isaiah 9:2 and in 42:7, the light of God can still reach those who are in darkness, even those who are in deep darkness. Not only is God present, but the power of his light, the reach of his light, can still reach those who are in darkness. In Isaiah 45:3, the ill-gotten treasures that are found in darkness are a gift from God for those who walk in his ways, who walk in the light. In other words, just as we see illustrated in this parsha, the Lord instructs Israel before they leave the darkness to go retrieve the treasures of silver and gold from those in darkness, from the Egyptians. And the prophet Isaiah refers to this in Isaiah 45:3. In Amos 5:18 and 20 and Zephaniah 1:14 and 15, we come to understand and appreciate that the day of the Lord is a day to be feared, a day of dread, because the day of the Lord is a day of darkness. And that can be quite a juxtaposition for how we often imagine the day of the Lord or the work of God. And when we think about what we've been talking about this afternoon and evening for some of you, that darkness is an instrument, this east wind instrument that is used to confront. And it's also an instrument used to as a prelude or to go before as a forerunner. And these are things that happen in the day of the Lord. The Lord brings a prelude in the day of the Lord that leads us in the direction we're going. And it brings us a prelude to the message that God is delivering. And it is an instrument used to confront, both in something that's positive and good and something that's negative and difficult. In the apostolic writings, we read the words of Yeshua in Matthew 6:23, also in Luke 12:3, that if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And of course, this is a Hebrew idiom that we've heard Bob talk about on many, many, many occasions, that a good eye is a Hebrew idiom for being generous and practicing generosity. And a bad eye is a Hebrew idiom for not only being stingy and selfish, but also destructive. And it's a rhetorical question that Yeshua is asking here in the Gospels, that if the I is bad, if the I is selfish, if not the I, but if the individual is selfish, if our walk and the ways in which we live, the way we conduct our behavior and our actions, if it is selfish, if it's narcissistic, if it is thievery, if it is not generous, then the rhetorical question is, how great is that darkness? At what point does that darkness grow in such a way that we are now blinded from the light that would shine? Because that's the point, is that darkness isn't static. When it's left unresolved, when it's left unchecked, the darkness swells and grows. How great is that darkness becoming? In Matthew 10:26, so have no fear of them, for nothing is covered that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops. And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven. I put this reference here for one particular reason. I probably should have highlighted this, or maybe bold to draw our attention to it when I put the notes together. But in verse 30 of this passage, it says, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. And there's a lot of nuance to what Yeshua might be saying here. But I've always found it very interesting that in recent science, we've discovered the DNA structure. And it seems to suggest here, with what we know and what we're coming to further appreciate, that at least in a Midrashic way, the counting of the hairs is not so much about counting how many hairs are on my head, which that would be an easy count right now for all of you, even from the camera, except maybe for here. It's less about counting the number of individual hairs, but if we pulled the strand of hair out and we put it into a DNA test, the process of DNA testing, what we would see is the ability to number the DNA recorded in the hair. And by looking at the DNA structure of hair, of human hair, we can number or bring into account experiences this individual's had in their history. We can, from the measurement of the hair, measure or number the toxins that this individual has been exposed to, adversities this person has experienced. In many ways, the counting of the hair is like counting the rings of a tree. If you cut a tree down and you look at the tree rings, and you look at the thickness versus the thinness of certain rings year after year after year, because we know the rings are proportional to the age of the tree. But when we look at those rings, we can actually number or count the years of drought versus the years when they had plenty of water or excess water. And in many of the same ways, through DNA science and epigenetic studies, we can count or number the hair of an individual and know their history. And it says here that the Lord is able to count the hairs of our head. In other words, it's a coded message for saying that which is hidden, because many people don't talk about their history. Many people have difficult histories. Many people have had exposure to toxic stress and childhood adversities, and they've had exposure to trauma. They've had exposure to terror. They've had exposure to other matters that have impacted them negatively, and that is often not seen, not heard, not talked about. It's outside the narrative, but the Lord knows. In other words, that which is in shrouded in darkness, the Lord knows. John 1:4, in him was life, talking about Yeshua, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The night is far gone. The day is at hand, Paul writes in Romans 13:12. So then let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. So based on what we've been looking at today in our Parsha study, we ask the question, what are the works of darkness? And what have we learned from this? What we've learned in this Parsha, the works of darkness, is that it's myth, as opposed to the sovereignty of God. In other words, the myth that's proposed in the darkness is that there are demonstrations of power and strength and authority and validity is found, and who is the stronger of the gladiators versus the truth of the sovereignty of God, justice, compassion, and human dignity. The works of darkness, as we've looked at, is it takes the symbols of life and it turns them into instruments or agents of death. And so we look around in our culture, in our society, in what ways is our society and our culture transforming what was previously or otherwise a symbol of life into now an instrument of death. And when we disrespect, disregard the structures, the boundary lines as the Creator put them in place of the universe, nature, and ethics, then darkness prevails. That is the works of darkness for which the Lord is bringing us from. Societies that view particular notable individuals with a sense of absoluteness of authority and who empower these individuals with opportunities to minimize and marginalize other human beings, that is the work of darkness. Cultures that tolerate the death, destruction, and the detriment of children is the work of darkness. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but in the United States alone, there are over 1.5 million children who are no longer living with their birth families. An agency of the state has taken them away to put them with another family or another context in order to be cared for and to be in their life to be preserved. And yet in that extraction from their birth family, they're often placed with families who are unprepared to deal with the toxic stress and trauma that these children have been exposed to. There is a brain development that takes place rapidly from the time of conception in utero to the time this child becomes 5 years of age. Rapid brain development. And when the child is not loved, cared for, and nurtured, when the child does not experience a healthy, secure, stable attachment in their life, this child grows up, as it were, with a chaotic brain patterns. And we have cultures, we have societies that are tolerating the conditions that are robbing children of their health at their most vulnerable time of their life, the time of in utero and in the first 5 years of their life. That is the works of darkness. Mark 10:14, also in 19:14, but when Yeshua saw it, he was indignant. What was it he saw? Adults restraining children. And when Yeshua saw it, he was indignant. And he said to them, let the children come to me. Do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. And what does he do? And he took them, the children, in his arms and blessed them, laying his hands on them. And so with that, we will conclude our study. I'll bring my attention back to all of you. And for your comments and what you would like to share, any questions you might have, thank you for being a part of this today.
Ronnie, this is David. Did you say that there were, do you have notes, or can I guess to get the notes for this, I would have to get the complete Jonathan Sacks compendium of essays that he's written. Is that correct?
To get all of the access to the articles that he's written, yes.
Okay. But as far as notes for tonight,
Did you receive the email? Did you receive an email from Bob Gorlick of today's notes?
I did not. I received the email, but there were no notes attached to it.
Okay.
Me, anyway, that was.
If you will get me your email address, and we had talked earlier about that on another matter, I will be glad to send you the notes for today. And I apologize.
Okay. If you didn't receive. That would be great.
Oh,
hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I forgot your name. Rob.
Robert.
Robert. Okay.
Roderick. Yes.
Oh, Roderick. Okay.
Yeah. Robert. Yeah. Robert Gorlick is the other guy.
Yes. Right. In that last section that you were talking about, cultures that tolerate the death, destruction, and detriment of children, also what comes to mind is how much abortion is going on in the United States and throughout the world. That also came to mind.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. And that is an interesting point, and I'm glad you brought that up. There is a lot of discussion between the rabbis because there's not a consensus per se among all the rabbis on the issue of not so much of the termination or the abortion, but as to the question of when life begins at conception or at birth. That is an ongoing question, and it's not a question that some people would say that Torah answers the question. And they often will draw from David's words, in my mother's womb, I was fearfully and wonderfully made. And that's a strong statement. I think that's a very, very strong statement. But by itself is not necessarily conclusive. What is interesting, Jennifer, and for all of us, again, is some recent science. I referenced in the teaching today about DNA. But you might have heard me reference something called epigenetics. And epigenetics is the newest of the science of genetic research. And there's a lot of epigenetics that's still undergoing, and there's a lot we still don't know that's being discovered. However, in the research that has been done, and when I say research, I'm not talking about conjecture or theory. I'm talking about actual empirical data that has been found to be true in epigenetic study. So, if you will, the DNA code, the genetic code, indicates our predisposition for or not for a particular thing. So as an example, I have blue eyes, but if you were to meet my mother and father and my sister, you would see they have brown eyes. So I know I have in my genetic code blue eye gene and a brown eye gene. Something determined that my blue eye gene would be turned on and my brown eye gene would remain turned off. And that determinant is called epigenetic. Epigenetics is the switch. So we have switches on our genetic code, and some of the switches are open and some are closed. Does that make sense? Now, here's the question. Here's the real interesting question, because you know, I'm 60 years old, and my entire life, the debate has been over when does life begin, conception or birth. It's been an either or question. It's either this or that. And epigenetics has introduced a third option. So the question is, Roderick has blue eyes because his epigenetic switch for blue eyes was turned on, but his brown eye gene switch, epigenetic switch, was turned off. And the question is, when was that determined? And it was not determined at birth, and it was not determined at my conception. That was determined at my mother's conception. That's science. That's why when we think about our predispositions, it is both nature and nurture. It's nature because of genetic coding and inherited history from our predecessors. But it's also nurture because these switches, not all of them, but some of these switches, based upon our experience on how we are nurtured and our experience in being nurtured, particularly when we were very young, we can flip the switch. So a child who has a predisposition towards resiliency can have that switch thrown if early in their life they're overly exposed to chaos and abuse and neglect. And so nature and nurture are both in play here. And I don't want to get too far off the topic, but my point being is that I think the larger point, Jennifer, that you would be making is that a society and a culture that has no respect for the child in utero is a society that's reflective of the works of darkness.
Yes.
Thank you for your comment. Another question or comment. Sunflower writes, Shabbat Shalom. Can you please send the notes to me also? Again, I apologize that the notes didn't reach you. Also, would you connect learning to view things from a Hebraic perspective from perhaps a traditional religion, non-Hebrew Christian, to having an open learning mind? Also, cultures that teach and kill these children, train them as martyrs, is radical Islam. So we do see in people groups like Hamas and others where children in kindergarten, and I have videos that I've watched of children in preschools who are children of Hamas being given toy guns and toy knives and taught how to subversively maneuver through crowds of people to do harm and to kill, training children as instruments of war. And that is something that's not only happened in history, that is something that's happening today, right now. And whatever the culture, whatever the religious tradition, when we have a tendency to not be open to learning, then we are no longer growing. You know, you might have heard some people say, I want you to accept me for who I am. Okay. But that's because that individual has put themselves in a box. It's not enough that I be accepted for who I am. It also is important that I be accepted for who I am becoming. And more important than you accepting me for who I'm becoming, I have to accept me for who I am becoming. I have to acknowledge my own growth. And that's how we, if we're growing, then we're going to have an optimum life. right? And that's the work of light, is to lead all of us, not only out of darkness into light, but the work of light is that we would grow in that. We would grow in the light. And this is something we find with children who have had severe childhood adversity, trauma, and they're now in a safe, nurturing, caring home. They often are resistant to that because they're not accustomed to order. They're accustomed to chaos. And we all fear what we don't know, what we don't understand. And so these children have to learn how to be comfortable and to thrive in the light. Does that make sense? Israel spent more than 400 years in bondage. So they had multiple generations of trauma. So there was the nature part of that. But then there was the nurture part of how they were dealt with in their generation. So when you think about those that left Egypt versus those who went into the promised land, how many of the first generation that left Egypt went into the promised land? Historians estimate close to 2 million people left Egypt and followed Moses into the wilderness. So what's the ratio between 2 million people that leave and two that enter into the promised land? Joshua and Caleb. Because the wilderness experience is learning how to live in the light. And the first generation didn't learn it. Not enough to enter the promised land except for two, including Moses and Aaron and Miriam. They're leaders. But their children went in. See, we're back to the children. We're back to the children. Thank you, Ed, for your comment. Appreciate that. And Beth Ann, thank you for your comment. Baruch Hashem. Other questions? Well, Sandy, it's a sneak peek of what's going to come. Sandy has invited Bob and I to come out to Missouri and to spend some time talking with some folks on this very thing. So
I can't wait. It's going to be awesome.
So those of you who want to make the track over to Missouri,
the middle of nowhere.
Well, if you'll come in the middle of April to the middle of nowhere, we hope we will find ourselves in the middle of the Lord's presence.
That's right. That's right.
In the middle of some good food and some good times.
That's right.
Yeah. Sandy's, Beth Ann's asking where, tell us again, where in Missouri?
Well, I've got all kinds of noise going on in the house right now. It's about 90 miles straight north of Kansas City. So
that puts you close to the Iowa border?
Yeah, I'm only 20 miles from Iowa.
Okay.
And,
so if you get to Iowa, you went too far. Come back.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're all welcome. Come. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It'll be a good time.
Yes, yeah. It will.
So, other thoughts or questions? Well, then I will wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, if it's still Shabbat for you. And if it's already the beginning of the new week, then Shavuot Tov. May the Lord make you prosperous and creative and productive in every way. And look forward to seeing you next Sabbath. Bob will be back as God provides. He'll be teaching next Sabbath. So thank you all. And I wish you all well. Bye-bye for now.